Take a network break, fire up the CLI, and route some virtual donuts to your mouth and join us for our weekly dissection of tech news. I'm Drew Connery Murray. Greg Farrow is in the belly of the beast out in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, it's weird here. Weird. You know, there's all this Silicon Valley stuffness going on.
Well, you're like super Silicon Valley right now because you've tucked yourself away in a little like public workspace facility, right? A WeWork shop.
Yeah, I'm at WeWork, of course, which is this one of the Silicon Valley venture capital unicorn things.
So I'm imagining like free beer and dogs and snacks and coffee and
free
hipsters.
Beers, free snacks, all the coffee you can destroy yourself with, funky furniture and the whole nine yards. And of course, then you walk out on the street and all you're doing is dodging marijuana smoke, human feces on the footpath.
Oh,
you know, people sleeping in doorways and you know, all that. But aside from that, no, Silicon Valley, the excitement of the unreal,
the libertarian paradise.
It's, well, something like that. Yeah.
All right. Well, we've got some news to get to and maybe some more commentary about Silicon Valley at the end of the show. But first, today's show is being sponsored in part by the WAN Summit. This is a conference where you can learn about how your peers are selecting and deploying SD-WAN, preparing their WAN for cloud and data center migrations, and more tech goodies. WAN Summits are coming to New York, Frankfurt, London, and other cities. You can get details and sign up at wansummit.com and save 20% with the code PacketPushers. Just head on over to wansummit.com. And stay tuned after the news for our sponsored conversation with CloudGenix. We're going to talk with CEO Kumar Ramachandran. We'll talk about the validation of the SD-WAN market and the evolution of the WAN and branch routers. All right, to the news, we're going to start with security. Oracle has released its January critical patch update advisory. It's got a whopping 238 critical patches.
Yeah, I mean, 238 patches, which is just insane. It's like Oracle suddenly discovered security. I mean, people have been slagging Oracle off a really bad security posture and just saying, you know, works as advertised and claims.
So here's their revenge, right? Yeah, we're taking it seriously. And here's 200-something vulnerabilities we just dropped on your desk.
No, that works as designed, like insecure protocols that have no authentication. And if you want to solve that, you know...
Well, I should say, apparently this update does include fixes for Spectre and Meltdown, which we're also going to talk about a little later, but I'm sure that may be added to the total.
But I think about, look at it this way. If you're an Oracle customer and you've been, you know, you're into the Oracle ecosystem and you're loving the, you know, like if you're into that and all of a sudden you get slapped with 238 patches. So let's say a quarter of them or a tenth of them, you know, fixing 20 patches, you could be taking down some of your most critical Oracle systems, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So all of a sudden you're expected to patch these because now they're in the public, right? Your exploits, and especially if your Oracle system's public facing, it's out reaching out to customers, you're doing B2B online or, you know, B2C or whatever it is. So now all of a sudden you've either got to rush a patch through this weekend and spoil your personal life, or you've got to be rushing to your ODS systems to try and put some mitigations in place, like to detect these things, or you've got to be boosting your monitoring so that you can start to detect if you're being attacked by these now publicly available vulnerabilities, which I am very confident people are running around attempting to weaponize as soon as possible, right?
Yeah, if not sooner.
So I just sort of looked at this and thought, this is really stupid. Why would you have like these mega patch releases across so many products? You just got to hate your customers. Honestly, like, how much do you hate your customers? You know, I get that it's good for Oracle maybe to do it in a big beast of a thing, you know, and they get a bit of press and marketing, but your customers are sitting there going like, oh Christ, now I've got to spend days working this out, and then I've got to put mitigation, now I've got to rush a patch. So, you know, the next quarter is basically just spent sorting this out. It really should be a much more smoother, continuous, you know, like every second week something gets announced so that people can get this sorted out.
Your Microsoft Patch Tuesday, you know what's coming, and it's coming every Tuesday.
Yeah, that's right. And the idea is that you put a couple of patches out every week, and then, you know, every Tuesday you sit down and work out which patches relate to you, and do I have to, you know, flip the panic switch and shut down the, turn off the firewall because it's, you know, this is a mission. You know, this just doesn't make sense. This is like a big company doing what's good for a big company, you know, convulsively pooping out all the patches at once and forcing a deadline so that everybody gets their fixes in, but really not caring about your customers. Just not good.
It's tough. It's obviously they have an obligation to their customers to keep them secure and updated, but 238 cramming down your throat in one drop is it's a lot.
Aside from the fact that, you know, obviously their products are pretty insecure if you're doing that many bugs, but and also I guess Oracle is being pretty talking a big game about the cloud. Do you think this could drive them towards the cloud? A bit self-serving, doesn't it?
I guess so.
I know that's really cynical, but I wouldn't put anything past Oracle.
All right. Well, we mentioned Spectre and Meltdown as part of the cause for that Oracle giant release. And so we've got a little bit more news about those two vulnerabilities. Intel is reporting that some of its processor families are experiencing unexpected reboots after Intel patches have been applied. These affected platforms include Ivy Bridge, Sandy Bridge, Skylake, and Kaby Lake. These are some of the newer platforms in Intel's family. So serious stuff.
Yeah, so of course, these patches have two problems. One is they're causing problems. A lot of companies like Windows, Microsoft Windows was rolling out a series of patch updates for the workaround in the operating system, and they were actually causing some machines, a limited number of machines, to just die or to reboot spontaneously or something like that. So, you know, the idea that these patches are solved or managed is actually not very true. But in this case, there's a whole bunch of stuff going on where people are reporting out on their cloud instances. So I've seen a number of tweets go by this week with blog posts or snapshots where CPU has actually doubled. And keep in mind that you're paying Amazon for that CPU.
That's right. Yes, you are.
All of a sudden, your AWS bill doubled, you know, or the compute part of your AWS bill doubled. And that is not a good look. There's a lot of unhappy people here.
That's right. Well, Intel, speaking of performance, they released some benchmark test data on the impact of the patches. Their testing ranges from a performance degradation of 0 to just 4%. But of course, that varies widely based on use case and application type. And it's also Intel doing its own testing. So take it with a grain of salt.
Yes. And of course, we've got a bunch of, let's just point out that there's still a bubbling sort of discontent around Intel's AMF, the active management framework that's inside the system. And also the Minix thing that we reported, those things are still insecure. So what's happening here is sort of like a bit of a PR nightmare for Intel. They're in a difficult situation where not only have there been these, you know, issues about these other tools that have been exploitable once you get access to the physical server, now you've got this. It's not going to be good, especially at a time when AMD is resurgent and ARM is actually out there looking to take some of this market share. You look at this and you actually start to think to yourself, you know, Intel could have a problem here if it can't get on top of this and produce quality outcomes for its customers.
Yes, although we should say that AMD and ARM may also be vulnerable to the techniques because it's actually based on how the CPU does some of its work. So this is not just an Intel problem, although Intel being the 900-pound gorilla takes most of the flack.
Mm. I just think it's interesting that, you know, like, this series of things, it's like, you know, Annus Horribilis sort of thing. And then, of course, the CEO is selling all the shares. Like,
that also looks terrible.
It just looks terrible. I don't think there's anything, as I said to you, I believe that he posted the fact that he was going to do this. And the fact is that he sold all the shares he possibly could, and keeping only the bare minimum that he's required to keep. Now, that's perfectly acceptable, but people mostly expect the CEO to be, you know, to believe in the company that he works for.
So a little background on that. If I recall correctly, it was around November that the CEO of Intel had to file with the SEC to say, I'm going to sell these shares. So this was set in motion before the vulnerability was announced, but it's also possible Intel knew about it back in November. So
I thought it was he filed to sell the shares in September and sold them in November.
Or maybe that's what it was, yeah.
But in any case, he would have known about this because this vulnerability has been known about for nearly a year.
Right.
So he filed to sell the shares knowing that this was something that was coming. It's not the shares were filed and he said he was going to do it and then they happened later on.
Right.
That's, I think it's sort of like, you know, and Intel has known about this and this would have certainly been something that he would have known about.
Yes. If I was giving him PR advice, I would have said, take the hit, hold on to him, take the hit, because you need everything you can to look good and honest and decent. And I'm not saying there was anything, you know, untoward going on, but it doesn't look great.
It doesn't look great because it's not like he sold 10% or 30% or 50% of, you know, he sold every single share he could possibly sell, you know, in the terms of his employment agreement, which is probably the bit that sticks in your craw.
So speaking of patches, Cisco announced they have a vulnerability in their NXOS software. It's a small vulnerability, and there's a link to the show notes in it. But what's funny is that when Greg and I were researching this story and he tried to click on the link to read the vulnerability notice, it kicked off a bunch of your privacy alarms on your browser, right?
I can't read it at all. So if I actually go to read it in Safari, which has my ad blockers and some security, you know, not
privacy, tracking prevention, and yeah, privacy tools.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not you know, whatever it is that you want to do, but I actually had a look at all of the sites that it's actually connecting to load, and it's actually loading to 13 separate trackers.
Wow.
And this is a security breach, right? So this is just a standard security notice, no big deal, but it's talking to things like Brightcove and Akamai and Kmarkat, all these tags and, you know, all this other stuff for tracking where, and literally, so what effectively is happening here is that Cisco is tracking where you go on the internet. So as soon as you hit the Cisco site, all of these cookies are laid down in your browser, and Cisco is then tracking, they'll track where you go after this because those cookies are tracked in your browser. There are companies out there who specialize in tracking you, but that's fine. Because I can normally block those, but still get, but I can't actually load the page that I need to read because I have that stuff turned on.
And I will say that the same thing happened to me when I was trying to research that list of Oracle vulnerabilities. I tried to click on the link and Firefox said, you don't want to do that. And so I had to go to another browser that I use that doesn't have any privacy protection on it for cases like this. So, wow. Yes.
Like, you know, okay, Cisco, we get that you want to track what people are doing, but, you know, tone it at least. This is a security announcement.
Right. For your vulnerability announcements, maybe tone down the tracking.
At the very least. And maybe have a little bit of respect for your customers' privacy instead of, you know, abusing that. Anyway, whatever.
Anyway, yeah,
I'm sure that's going to fall on deaf ears.
You know? And I don't want to just...
everybody's doing it, you know?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I don't want to... It's Cisco and everybody else on the internet is essentially guilty of this, so...
Oh, Juniper's website. Oh, don't get me started. Yeah. And we've taken Juniper to task in the past, so just so you don't feel picked on. Yeah.
That's right. Everybody gets their chance in the woodshed.
That's it, yeah.
All right, one more story that jumped up to us. Last week we had talked about AT&T. They had to back out of a deal with Huawei around carrying the Chinese company's Mate 10 smartphone because of security concerns. There is now a Texas congressman who has introduced a bill that would explicitly prohibit the U.S. government from buying telco gear or services from Huawei and ZTE.
Well, you've got to imagine that in U.S. politics at the moment with the current environment that, you know, kicking companies, Chinese companies, has got to be like...
It's shooting fish in a barrel, literally.
Shooting fish in a barrel. And you might also perfectly reasonably suspect that somebody for like AT&T and Verizon might be using good old lobbying to get a senator to say exactly what they want them to say. Not that that's perfectly democratic, by the way. It's not. I wouldn't want to pick a position on this either way, right? Because it's perfectly reasonable to assume, given what we know about the Chinese government and the involvement in the companies that are Chinese, that they would use those companies for their own goals in the US in terms of intelligence or, you know, whatever, right? Mm-hmm, or mm-hmm. industrial espionage. It's perfectly reasonable to assume that. But the hypocritical part might be that it's also perfectly reasonable to assume that US companies are doing exactly the same thing in China.
Sure, yes.
If I'm the NSA or the whatever. And so when you get kicked out of China, please don't whine. Because just remember, this cuts both ways.
That's right. Yes, if your lobbying arm was pushing this bill through or helping this congressman write it, then watch out, there could be blowback.
Yeah, and just remember here that the only person who suffers here is the customer. By some measures, depending on who you want to talk to, Huawei and ZTE are producing products that are definitely cheaper, and by some people's judgment, better than what you can get from the US companies, like the existing, you know, Ericsson, Nokia, Cisco, Juniper, you know, all those companies who have been producing this technology. You could argue that they are overpriced, have features that nobody wants, you know. However, I'm not going to make a judgment on those sorts of things. But keep in mind that if you start freezing people out, you're actually talking about a return to what we used to have, which was protectionism. And 25 years ago, those of us who remember the telco industry where ISDN in America was not the same as ISDN in Australia was not the same as ISDN, and that encouraged local markets, inefficient markets. It's very much a, you know, and it's hypocritical to say that this is protecting our democracy when what you're actually doing is absolutely the opposite. You're preventing people from choice. So I just wanted to point out the hypocrisy in this, not so much the fact that they want to ban Huawei and ZTE.
Hypocrisy noted.
Yeah, all around. 360 degrees of perspective there.
All right, a quick break to tell you about our sponsor today, WAN Summit. You're constantly adapting your wide area network to accommodate new business requirements, technologies, and applications. So WAN Summit is the place to learn how others are doing this, tackling key challenges like maximizing your branch bandwidth while minimizing costs, supporting cloud applications, and so on. WAN Summits are two-day program-intensive conferences that include case studies, interactive panels, and peer-to-peer networking opportunities. You know, for example, at a recent WAN Summit, a major U.S. retailer shared its entire migration process to SD-WAN, including including the lessons learned, how it chose a provider, the security issues it had to address, and more. So there's a WAN Summit coming to a location near you. Upcoming shows are going to be in New York, London, Frankfurt, Singapore, and more. You can find out where they're going to be at WANsummit.com. You can also register there. And if you use the code PacketPushers, you can save 20%. So head on over to WANsummit.com and use the code PacketPushers, and you'll get 20% off.
Yeah, interesting conference. I did. I've never actually been, and I'm not going to this one. But I did get access to some of the documentation from one of the conferences, and there's some interesting stuff there.
Okay, yeah, it sounds like they're putting a lot of emphasis on real world use cases, and that's always very valuable. So yeah, go check it out and see if it's a fit for you, and they're going to be in your location.
Definitely.
Back to the news. 2 years after stepping down as Cisco CEO, Uncle John Chambers is back in business. He has launched a VC firm. It's called JC2 Ventures, and it's going to focus on IoT, InfoSec, and apparently agricultural tech.
JC2, just a touch of ego there.
A little bit eponymous there, yeah.
It's a bit like, you know, does that make Cisco JC1? That's just...
I don't know. I'm pretty sure Cisco doesn't want to see it that way, but yeah, it's a good point.
I don't know. Maybe that's a little too cynical. Everybody seems to think that John Chambers has got magic. Now, one of the things that I wanted to point out here is that Cisco is very much built in a model of from General Electric or GE in the 1980s, when they wanted to buy a whole bunch of companies, and they sort of produced these conglomerates. And Cisco has sort of adapted parts of that model to. Sometimes I call it the Cisco supermarket model, you know, 10 aisles of IT infrastructure products. And if you head down the networking aisle, there's a blah, blah, blah.
Something for everybody.
And what I noticed this week is that there's now rumors that GE is planning to break itself up. So this idea of building a massive multi-platform conglomerate and the idea that, you know, the bigger you get and the more business you bring an umbrella might actually be collapsing. And if so, is there a case that big IT giants should be doing like we saw HP break up into HP and HPE, and then we saw HPE then further break itself up and get rid of the legacy parts so it could just focus down on the things that were going to be worthwhile having in the future? And you've got to ask yourself, is the Cisco business model as it is reaching the end of its life cycle as the market changes? Not that anything is wrong with Cisco or whatever, but I'm sometimes asking myself, has Cisco's just got too much going on under a single brand to make sense going forward?
You know, I guess I take your meaning, but we also see different approaches to the changes that are affecting the IT market. Like, for instance, Dell EMC, instead of divesting, they got bigger and then merged, right? So,
yeah.
And look at Amazon, which is buying companies left and right, moving into new areas left and right. That's also a growth strategy. So, you know, pick your poison, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, on one hand, I don't want to go back to, you know, in an era of hyperconvergence, you know, where you want to buy your servers and your storage and your networking and your cloud, private cloud platform and your hybrid cloud, you want all that to be unified. But on the other hand, you're also asking for an awful lot of technology to operate inside what, you know, and things that actually sort of, it's very difficult to get them to come together, if you know what I'm saying, like to aggregate those different
those different components. Yeah. That to make a stack that actually works together is difficult.
Yeah. Like Nutanix is very focused on making that stack and have shown that it's certainly possible, but you could argue that maybe these companies would be better if they were in smaller chunks and more focused on what they were doing instead of sort of spreading their attention and funding and, you know, across multiple competitive things.
That's right. Yeah, well, I mean, maybe Mr. Chambers is seeing an opportunity here to try a different model if one or two of his bets pay off and start to grow. Apparently, he's put money into around 8 companies so far, a couple of security startups, a couple of drone-related startups, and apparently, this one jumped out at me, there's a food company that works with edible insects. They're trying to promote edible insects.
That's so Silicon Valley. Every single one of those is Silicon Valley.
It totally is.
The edible insects thing is because everybody says you won't be able, like we can't continue to produce meat and eat meat like we do today because there's just not enough resources or global warming, whatever the reasons are, right?
Insects will be a cheap source of protein in the future, yes.
Yeah, yeah, and that is so Silicon Valley. That's... And then, of course, drone-related startups, Silicon Valley, everybody's going to want a drone, you know, blah, blah, blah. It does seem a bit, right in the middle of the Silicon Valley hype cycle, for sure. That's
the sweet spot. Okay, we've got some financial news to talk about. IBM is first up. They reported their fourth quarter and full fiscal year results. Big Blue posted revenue of $22.5 billion for the quarter, which is up 4% year over year. Unfortunately, for the entire fiscal year, IBM is still in the red by 1% based on an annual revenue of $79.1 billion.
Yeah. So what's amazing about this is the first time in 22 quarters that IBM has posted growth.
I saw that headline and my jaw hit the floor.
Yeah, 5.5 years of shrinking slowly, but a lot of people point the finger at what IBM's been doing for the last 10 years is financial engineering itself. So it promised investors that it would return this much dividend and it would engineer its business to do so. And it conducted an awful lot of internal financial engineering to return cash to shareholders in the forms of buybacks. As a result, the business suffered because there just wasn't enough money going back into the business to produce new products, to keep staff trained, and then ultimately the company started to shrink. But it was actually a long-term decline. So people are all very excited about this because Big Blue posted a revenue gain 4% in a single quarter. Now, the question is, will they do it again in 22 quarters? And the answer is maybe. Who knows? I wouldn't like to bet on it. It would be my response. Yeah.
And one little note, the cloud organization part of the business, they had a pretty good quarter, 30% growth year over year, pulling in $5.5 billion for the fourth quarter.
Yeah. So just in case you didn't think the cloud was a real thing, and this is one of the things, is the simple point of fact is that companies are all testing it out to a greater or lesser degree. And so you're going to see the vendors following the money. They're not necessarily convinced that cloud's good for them in the long term, but they're going to go wherever customers are going. And if you're spending money on cloud, the vendors are going to be there to take your money off you. I mean, provide value to you.
Cloud surcharge. I'm really curious. In the press release announcing the results, they made some noise about business blockchain and artificial intelligence. So curious to see if IBM can really make businesses out of those two things. I think that's probably a few years out, but something to watch. And moving on, Barclays Bank recently downgraded Juniper Network stock in anticipation of pressure in the routing market. That is according to a story in Seeking Alpha. Juniper is going to release its latest fiscal results on January 30th, so we don't have numbers yet, but in a couple of weeks we will.
Yeah, this is all analysts always sort of changing their positions. And in this case, it was Barclays downgraded Juniper, saying that the trail forward gets bumpier. So what does that mean? Well, who knows?
But, I love these mysterious prognostications and yeah. Proclamations.
What happens is these financial analysts have access to a lot of data. They actually have people out there doing surveys in the market and talking to people and finding out what's happening. And they might have sort of some, you know, a survey might have come back and said, you know, things don't look great in this particular market segment, you know, I don't know, federal government or whatever it is. And they then say, you know, overall, this. So when a major analyst downgrades the stock, it often has an impact of a couple of percentage on the point. I think maybe Arista's starting to have some impact here. So we've seen Arista try and turn their Ethernet switching chassis into a routing chassis and saying that, you know, it's got routing capabilities for 100 gig and 200 gig and 400 gig. And that is really in the cloud space. Cisco's not present there. So if you're Amazon or, you know, Google or Weibo or Tencent, you probably aren't buying Cisco routers, you're buying Juniper routers. And Arista is trying to get into that space by leveraging its existing relationship in the data center lands. You can't actually say for certain, we'll have to wait for 2 weeks to see what Juniper's results look like. But Juniper does have a bumpy road ahead. It doesn't seem to have a cloud vision, which everybody else seems to have. That seems to be worth talking about. But they're still a good company. They've still got great products. So,
Yeah, I'm sure they'll find a way. One more story. NetScout says it's going to miss its quarterly financial target. The company is preparing to release their financial results also at the end of January. The NetScout CEO, Anil Singhal, said, quote, "We are unable to achieve our targets as service provider capital spending in North America remains under significant pressure." Meaning it sounded like there was at least one of their tier one service provider customers who didn't spend as much as they thought it was going to spend, and it kind of cratered this quarter.
I said something about this and somebody just turned around to me and said, "Are they still in business?" Which,
ouch.
Which was, I actually sort of agree with them. I'm not sure who's buying NetScout in the modern era. I mean, when you look at sort of more interesting products from people like, you know, show sponsors like Deepfield and Kentik, what is NetScout bringing us? We've also seen this, the US service providers basically halt their spending as they work out if they've got an open source strategy to change to.
That's right.
So, yeah, and, you know, when the elephants dance, sometimes the mouse gets squashed.
Mm-hmm.
This is what it feels like, you know?
Yeah, I think so.
If AT&T freezes its, you know, purchase of a certain set of products because it's waiting to see, we just recorded a show recently with AT&T talking about their distributed network operating system, their idea of a universal NOS for networking. Well, that could really change things, and maybe this is where it's headed.
entirely possible. I'm also thinking of coverage we did a while back on HPE when they had a quarter affected by one of their big cloud customers who just wasn't buying as much as they had anticipated. Real danger in sort of having one or two big elephants who can crush you when they when they aren't buying.
Well, NetScout's a billion-dollar company.
That's right. They're still they're a substantially sized organization, yes.
Yeah, and considering it's basically visibility and monitoring, you've got to figure that that's got to be under threat in the longer term as networks change. You know, SDN takes away a lot of the need for this tooling, I think. Or there's a risk of that, at least.
Yeah, certainly disruption is in the works.
Could be, yeah. Yep. Interesting to see how they work it out.
All right, that wraps up our news analysis for this week. Please stay tuned for a Coffee Talk conversation with CloudGenix. We're going to be talking about the evolution of the WAN and your branch routers, and that's coming right up. Welcome to Coffee Talk, a fast, informative, sponsored conversation that helps expand your tech horizons in about the time it takes to recaffeinate. Our sponsor today is CloudGenix, and we're joined by the founder and CEO, Kumar Ramachandran. We're going to talk about changes in the SD-WAN market and how the technology is evolving. Kumar, welcome to the show, and let's start talking about market consolidation. In the past few months, Cisco has picked up Vitella, VMware bought VeloCloud. What does this mean for the SD-WAN market in general and for the standalone SD-WAN vendors out there?
Hey, thrilled to be here. You know how when acquisitions happen, analysts like to say it's a validation of the market. Mm-hmm. We just had that happen times two.
Double validation?
Exactly. I like to think that it was validation and a little bit of confession. Right, the reason you have to inorganically acquire products, you know, you're also telling your customers that maybe what you had before, you know, didn't pass muster.
It's always the disruption thing. You know, you've got to admit that your product that you own is obsolete. And I think for big companies, it's always interesting to realize that they're not very good at making products. In the current era of big companies, they made a good product 20 years ago, but now they buy it from someone else. And this is just that cycle going on. Good products come from outside. And when the market is ready and mature, the big companies come in and say, right, now we're ready to actually sell this to our customer base. So yeah, I think they're admitting two things. One, they aren't able to innovate from internally. And two, this is a market that customers really want and they need to hurry up and get into it because customers are spending money on it.
Oh, you couldn't have said it better, right? See, the fundamental challenge for companies like Cisco really is that they've done really well in layer three. And if all you know is layer three, everything seems like layer three, right? If you only have a hammer with you, everything looks like a nail. I think the core challenge is that the way the technology and networks are evolving, it's really moving from layer three based networks to layer 7 through layer 3 networks. And Cisco just has always been challenged when it comes to layer 7, right? We saw, you know, them being challenged in layer 4 through 7 based offers. And I think they'll really have to organize themselves differently this time round. Maybe fourth time's a charm.
Well, they, you know, big companies are big companies. Who knows how fast they can move and change? So speaking of change, how do you see SD-WAN changing over the next 5 years? Well, like we've seen over the last two, maybe 3 years of SD-WAN, we've seen it move from, you know, we started with a very simple multi-path delivery, and then we talked about the monitoring, we talked about the asset management. Where's it going to go from here? If we've got all this money rushing into this market and we've got customers saying, I want that, what do you, as, you know, the CEO of CloudGenix, where are you going to set sail towards? What's the goals?
Yeah, so fundamentally, I believe that cloud is the most dramatic transformation of our lives, right, when it comes to enterprise IT, because it fundamentally changes storage, networking, applications, IT, just across the board, it has a very material impact. So when you look at the WAN and remote office, the old model, right, used to be that you have a hardware router going over MPLS to data center. And then we had SD-WAN emerge. And then Gen 1 solutions, like you said, they really were focused on saying, hey, how do we use broadband to enable that kind of data center access, right? Whether it's better VPNs, doing some amount of link aggregation, that was the focus on those solutions. I think true north and where the puck is going is really answering the question, how do you enable the remote office to consume cloud, SaaS, public cloud, private cloud-based applications simultaneously or any form of connectivity at the remote office.
And you won't even know which one of those you're going to go for, because if you're building a WAN today, you're not going to know if you're going to be building a private cloud based around a private cloud stack, or whether you're going to be in Azure, or whether you're going to be in AWS, or whether you're going to be in Google. You won't even, you know, are you going to keep your private MPLS? Are you going to be just all broadband? How you can't make those choices today because they just don't exist.
That's right. And when you architect infrastructure, you have to build your infrastructure in a way that is going to enable that wave of IT, despite not knowing the specific location. I was talking to the CIO last week of a Fortune 50 company. And he turns around and says, listen, we know we are doing cloud. Today, you know, there is about 20% of our enterprise business traffic is coming from SaaS locations. We are making a big bet on a combination of Azure and AWS. And actually, believe it or not, they have a little bit of Oracle too. Remember how Larry Ellison said the cloud would never be a thing?
Well, of course. I mean, you know, there's always – we should have mentioned Oracle, because at the end of the day, if you've got Oracle applications, you're talking about decade-long investment cycles in Oracle. If you've got it and you want to, you know, modernize it in some way, you're going to go to Oracle and get it, but you're going to start turning down the acceleration. You know, you're going to back off your Oracle and start look for other ways to get away from Oracle and get into public cloud and open source solutions.
That's exactly right. And so as these enterprises that historically have been conservative, they look at architecture. The fundamental requirement from IT is that I come in, specify what kinds of applications I'm delivering to my remote office, express a policy in three broad areas, you know, my business criticality / performance, my security rules, and my compliance rules. And then the absolute expectation is that the software-defined WAN automatically delivers those applications while fulfilling all those enterprise policies, right? To enable that transformation from the layer three up, instead the layer seven down model, you truly need this Gen 2 model of SD-WAN that CloudGenix delivers.
What do you mean by Gen 2? That's a term you just introduced.
Exactly. I asked it so that your viewers get a little curious.
They were paying attention.
Exactly. It was a little test. No, so Gen 1 was focused on broadband enablement, right? Every article you read in the last 2 years really spoke about how you're going to save a truckload of money by transitioning from MPLS to broadband. That's great, and I think that's a real cost saving, and we've seen customers enjoy those cost savings. But at some point, you're really looking at mega transitions, and the mega transition is the cloud. So if you're a Gen 2 SD-WAN solution, here are the things you need to be able to do. One, you need to be able to allow your administrator to come in and specify that policy that I just spoke about, and do near nothing else to get the network fully functional, and then be freely able to move. You're using SAP in your data center. You migrate to SAP HANA in the cloud. You should not have to change a single thing in your environment, right? Because you specified the policies, your expectation is going to be that the controller, the CloudGenix system, automatically reconfigures the network to deliver that application now from the cloud in an optimized manner. How do you do this? One, you need the big brain approach, right? You need a big eye in the cloud, so to speak. I almost liken it to the bad old days when we used to have printed out paper maps versus Waze, right? Waze is a big eye in the cloud.
Yeah, this idea of decentralized or distributed brains is just not going to cut it, I think, going forward, because the idea that one router can do what it does without knowing what the neighboring routers are doing or the neighboring devices are doing just isn't going to make sense when we live in a world of apps, and apps care about the client to the server. I just want to emphasize that so many people haven't got that yet. They're still thinking like packet by packet, hop by hop, or even TCP flow or TCAM entries or whatever it is, but it's not. It's actually, how does the client run this app? You know, it might be Google Docs, and it's going to connect to Google Doc at the other end. How are you going to route that? Are you going to route it over this broadband? Are you going to route it via head office? Are you going to route it to this CDN? You know, how are you going to filter that? How are you going to secure that? That's what you mean by this big brain in the cloud, just to try and break that down and explain that.
That's exactly right, because the moment you have that big brain in the cloud model, it's a prerequisite to being able to make the transition to an application-based network, right? And in an application-based network, you start looking at things like application end user response times, server response times. We had a great issue with one of our customers where, you know, at Columbia Sportswear, when they access Office 365 from their stores, the SharePoint or email, when they open trouble tickets with Microsoft, usually the Microsoft response will be, yeah, most likely your network must be broken. And then you go open a trouble ticket with the service provider. Their response is, yeah, Microsoft must be running hot or something like that. What we are able to do is say, hey, here was the response time on the LAN in the store. Here was the response time over the WAN in the network. And here's the data center response time for Microsoft. Now, if there's troubleshooting to be done, we know who to, you know, there's problem isolation already done. And then what is even more interesting is we use those metrics for traffic engineering. So the big brain in the cloud looks at that and says, okay, here's how we're going to reconfigure networks in real time to deliver this application in a great manner.
And I want to just tack back to something you raised about this notion of policy and configuration. With that big brain in the sky, the idea is that the administrator, the engineer, has to do less of the hand-to-hand configuration of each device because you've got some kind of programmatic capability in the controller to go out and push those policies without a lot of fiddling around with the CLI.
That's exactly right. So, you know, when you look at the big brain model, right, one, you get this true CLI-based approach. And then two, the unit of operation, rather than trying to code at a very low level, you know, in the application world, it's almost like trying to do assembly language coding versus, you know, developing in JavaScript, right? I'm trying to teach my 12-year-old daughter JavaScript, and she enjoys that. If I try to teach her assembly language, you know, she'll call my age out rather quickly.
For some definition of enjoyment.
Exactly. So. You know, you look at, you know, there was an article published, a case study published by one of our customers. It's out on LinkedIn. We can send it as a note to your viewers, where he calls out that for every 100 sites deployed with CloudGenix, compared to what they used to do with Cisco's various SD-WAN solutions, they have saved $1 million in deployment costs alone. This is not the WAN connectivity cost. This is not the cost of troubleshooting. This is not the cost of, you know, equipment, etc. Just the raw deployment. How much time it took setting up and configuring all your CLIs, pushing out the scripts, understanding the policies versus CloudGenix. Every 200 locations, they saved $1 million. Hard cost savings. I'll give a fun example for some of your users. Aaron's, they're a retail store with about 2,000 locations across North America. And as part of trying to manage the network, you know, they asked us the question, hey, for all our users on the go, administrators on the go, is there an easy way? Because we got 2,000 locations and they run a pretty lean, mean IT staff. So, you know, they wrote a little Slack bot on top of our controller. It's a little application on top of our controller. And you can now query it saying, hey, what's the status of the Aaron store in Santa Clara? And the Slack bot responds. Saying, yeah, it's doing really well. And then if you asked, how's the store in, let's say, San Francisco doing, it might say, you know, the store is in yellow status simply because one of the connections is not behaving the way it did, you know, the way it normally does, right? There's a deviation from normal that the system is starting to work around. It's not red, but it's yellow. And they can actually take an action to go take care of it.
I want to ask one question too. What we're seeing is, and jumping topics, I must say, we're seeing a lot of carriers and telcos and managed service providers announce that they're doing SD-WAN as a service. So you go from your single supplier WAN provider, you know, selling you your MPLS service, and now you're going to go to one provider and they're going to give you the routers on the end or the, you know, the boxes on the end and call it SD-WAN. What's your take? What's the CloudGenix take on that? What's the right way to be looking at it?
So before I give the CloudGenix take, I'll give you the what the CIO of, you know, the former CIO of Restoration Hardware, a person called Asad Jafri, said at a conference. You know, someone asked the exact same question of him, and he said, this sounds like an oxymoron, right?
Yeah.
And by the way, that's one of my favorite words because it feels like you insulted someone, but you didn't really say something bad. But when you look at it, fundamentally, here's what SD-WAN needs to deliver. SD-WAN's promise to the customer is that I will give you freedom from being tied down to any specific carrier, one. And then two, the solution will be dramatically simple to use, that I don't necessarily need all the management that I maybe previously required. Now, having said that, so as long as the solution meets those two requirements, then yes, I think there are some carriers who have their optics right, right? Yeah. Who understand that, hey, there's a generational shift happening with customers. We can't tie the customer down in ways that maybe in the past were okay. And they're able to provide offers that are interesting and compelling. But then you have a really large number of carriers who are trying to control the transition, right? Trying to slow down the transition. I just think that flies in the face of what customers are trying to do. And so if you can't deliver carrier freedom, it's a problem.
Yeah, I think the thing that people need to realize is a lot of the times they have a single carrier is because that was the only way it was possible to do it. The workload of, you know, having multiple carriers pointing fingers at each other with no evidence, no visibility, no proof that brownouts were happening on carrier A, because carrier A would just point at carrier B and vendor A would point at, you know, anybody but themselves. And I think the SD-WAN, you know, the controller and the statistics and the asset and the visibility that you get finally makes it possible to have multiple carriers and actually go, no, don't tell me what you think it would be. Here's the evidence that shows what it is, and it's possible to have multiple carriers for the first time. Something not historically possible.
Oh, what a great great clarification. At one of our customers, they want a managed service, right? So Wipro delivers a global managed service using CloudGenix, and it's a very interesting offer because it's a carrier neutral offer, right? Because Wipro doesn't provide connectivity. They manage the service for you. In that case, what the customer told Wipro is that, hey, I'd love for you to abstract away any carrier dependency, one, and then two, hold the carriers accountable to their SLAs. So Wipro turned to us and said, hey, how do we hold carriers accountable to their SLAs? Do we just sit down with them every month? You know, what is the operational model? So they drove us to providing very detailed analytics of carrier behavior, right? How was the link performance? How are my applications performing on those links? Was the carrier meeting their SLA regularly, but the out of SLA regularly? And this becomes even more critical as people look to consume broadband, LTE, etc., simply because, you know, MPLS has been more predictable, broadband maybe less so, and providing that real-time monitoring has been interesting. Your audience will appreciate that if you're trying to do the way you know the capacity of a link is you do a speed test, right? You flood the link with traffic. The downside of doing a speed test in real time in production is that then you're going to constantly flood the customer's network.
Well, that's right. At which point the customer's network isn't working.
Exactly.
Right. So it's kind of like, really, and it comes down to getting in the flow. And of course, there's a dozen different ways to actually get that visibility in case. But, I think the SD-WAN appliances, the intelligence and application centricity is going to give us what we need to do.
It truly does, right? And so what we are able to do is provide back to Wipro and the customer real-time visibility into even a broadband connection without flooding the network at all, right? So the customer actually knows they're getting what they're paying for.
All right, Kumar, we're kind of running up against the end of the show here. Where should folks go if they want to get more information?
Go to cloudgenix.com and you'll see a ton of information. You can also go to sdwan.org and there are some interesting case studies published out there too.
Fantastic. All right, well, that wraps it up for this episode of The Coffee Talk. Thank you, Kumar, for joining us, and thanks to everyone for listening. You can find this and many more fine, free technical podcasts, along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. You can also join our free membership program at packetpushers.net/members. You can also find us on LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, and give us a rating on iTunes. And last but not least, remember that too much technology would never be enough.